ta'ala, this feeling of beseeching him, this feeling of servitude that Amir al-Mu'mineen wanted us to feel when he comes forward and says and speaks to Allah, and he says to him, Ilahi kafani fakhran an akuna laka abda. Ya Allah, it is a matter of pride for me that I am your servant. Wa kafani azzan an takuna li rabba. And it's a matter of dignity for me and strength that you are my Lord. Anta kama uhib faj'anni kama tuhib. You are exactly how I want you to be, so make me how you want me to be.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
No doubt that snipers are working here. I've counted 10 bodies.
Now on the brink of a civil war, at least 70 dead so far, and the death toll rising.
What we saw here today was a revolution.
We've invested over $5 billion to assist Ukraine in these and other goals.
NATO has expanded into 13 countries, up to the borders of Russia. 13 countries.
The focus has to be on not allowing this crisis to turn into hot war between Ukraine and Russia.
Ukraine. It's an ancient and proud land with a rich history filled with much beauty, heroism, and sacrifice. Ukraine is a borderland, a place where east meets west. This is the flag of Ukraine. The blue represents the sky, the gold its seemingly endless fields of wheat. Ukraine is a prize many have sought, and much blood has spilled in the quest to possess it. Ukraine has been the pathway for Western powers as they attempted to conquer the East. Another historical document that changed the fate of Ukraine was the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of 1939, one of many such agreements being signed between European countries and rising Germany. Attempting to protect his nation from the approaching Nazi threat, Joseph Stalin negotiated a treaty of non-aggression with Adolf Hitler. While promising each other peace, the Soviet and German foreign ministers Molotov and Ribbentrop realigned the map of Eastern Europe, splitting it into German and Soviet spheres of influence. In January 1943, USSR troops started pushing the Nazis back, liberating one part of Ukraine after another. Western Ukraine was the last Ukrainian region held by the Germans, finally being liberated in October of 1944. The era of political and military tension between the US and the USSR lasted for nearly 45 years, keeping humanity under the constant threat of nuclear war. In this battle, the United States never lost sight of Ukraine's importance. U.S. intelligence kept a close eye on Ukrainian nationalist organizations as a possible source of counterintelligence against the Soviet Union. CIA documents that just recently have been declassified show strong ties between U.S. intelligence and Ukrainian nationalists since 1946. From the CIA agency report, it is clear that they were not mistaken about the nature of Ukrainian nationalist organizations or their leader, Stepan Bandera, himself. By 1954, the agency excused the illegal activities of the OUN security branch in the name of Cold War necessity. In 1949, Mykola Lebed, the man responsible for the massacres in Volhynia, was moved to the United States, where he died in 1989 without ever being investigated or pursued as a war criminal. The CIA moved to protect Ukrainian nationalist leader Mykola Lebed from criminal investigation by the Immigration and Naturalization Service in 1952. The Cold War would heat up and cool down by turns, while both rivals were obsessively building up military capacity. The turning point took place when the new era, Perestroika, came to the USSR with its new leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, in the middle of the 1980s. Perestroika meant restructuring towards liberalization and democratization. It certainly had a positive impact on the international situation.
Astonishing news from East Germany, where the East German authorities have said, in essence, that the Berlin Wall doesn't mean anything anymore.
But inside the USSR, the weakening of Kremlin control had different consequences. The people's growing discontent made Ukraine more vulnerable to outside forces, and a new kind of warfare was launched, one not known before, the color revolutions.
Violent clashes erupted in the Ukrainian capital Kiev as more than 100,000 people protested against a government decision to delay an association deal with the EU.
Arseniy Yatsenyuk, leader of the opposition party, Fatherland. Oleg Tagnibok, leader of the opposition nationalist far-right political party, Svoboda. Vitali Klitschko, leader of the opposition party, UDAR. Robert Perry is a longtime investigative journalist based in Washington, D.C., best known for his major disclosures about the Iran-Contra scandal in the 1980s. He is the founder of Consortium News, where he has reported extensively on the crisis in Ukraine and the forces behind the unrest.
An NGO is a non-governmental organization. Now, many NGOs are quite legitimate. They represent good causes. Maybe they help people in a country feed or deal with water problems or deal with various kinds of social problems. But there are some NGOs that have become funded by government entities and serve more the purpose of that government rather than trying to serve the people that they are ostensibly working for. One thing we saw in the 1980s, at that point the Central Intelligence Agency had been largely discredited because of scandals that had been exposed in the 1970s.
For 15 years, the CIA has secretly financed overseas activities of the National Students Association. But then there came to light a fantastic web of CIA penetrations.
So when the Reagan administration came in, there was this concept that instead of having the CIA, which traditionally would go into these different target countries, funding their media, funding NGOs, funding different political operations, that was essentially farmed out to a new organization called the National Endowment for Democracy, which was created in 1983. And it would do pretty much what the agency used to do. It would go into one of these countries and it would support various political groups, train activists, deal with journalists, business groups, and try to advance U.S. foreign policy interests, sometimes against the interests of the host government, the target government. And beyond that, they received financial and other logistical help from the National Endowment for Democracy and other U.S. agencies. That helped them training activists, working with journalists to get their side presented more favorably. They work on things like, how do you get traction? How do you get things to go viral? How do you then use that to generate support for your cause?
And support was generated.
Mustafa Nayem.
Mustafa Nayem, a founder of one of Ukraine's new media outlets.
Доброго дня.
Romatske TV knew very well how to make something go viral. It was his notorious Facebook post on November 21st, 2013, that brought the first crowds to Maidan. If you don't read the newspaper, you are uninformed. If you read the newspaper, you are misinformed. To deliver your message efficiently enough in the modern world with so many different technologies and means of communications, you must embrace them all. As the disturbing events of Euromaidan started on November 21st, 2013, three new TV channels went on the air and suddenly became stunningly popular in Ukraine. Spilno TV, November 21st. Romatske TV, November 22nd. And Espresso TV, November 24th, directly from opposition protest. These channels went viral, supporting the protests and encouraging more and more people to come to Maidan. November 30th of 2013 became the first turning point of Euromaidan and one of its most reported and mysterious events.
After riot police attacked peaceful protesters with clubs.
Happened in the early morning hours. The eyewitnesses that were there said that the police did use truncheons.
Coincidentally, Sergei Lovochkin is a close associate to many U.S. politicians. The security service of Ukraine had evidence that on that night, Lovochkin was in contact with opposition leader Yatsenyuk, where they discussed the clearing of Maidan on the pretext of installing the annual Christmas tree. News media reported that the riot police cruelly attacked the students peacefully sleeping in their tents, but scenes from the event seemed to tell a different story. It appears that the protesters were waiting for the police. Additionally, there were dozens of journalists and cameramen from all the new public TV news outlets prepared to cover the events. And most ominously, a group of well-trained young men arrived to Maidan almost simultaneously with the riot police. They infiltrated the crowd and began provocations with insults, stones, and torches.
The riot sector in Ukraine represents a part of the Ukrainian population that has often favored fairly extreme right-wing positions. They had militias that came especially during the Maidan protests. There were groups that were being shipped into Kiev, where they would provide the muscle, in effect, for the demonstrations. So the demonstrations went from being relatively peaceful political protests to being increasingly violent.
The first step in any detective work is to establish a motive. It is now said that Sergei Lovochkin is held in high esteem by his powerful U.S. friends. Outraged by what was reported in the news, the Ukrainian people came out in force on the next day to vent their anger with the police actions. As veiled and masked as the color revolutions can be, an attentive viewer can see subtle patterns and similarities revealing their true nature. To make crowds act as one obedient group, they have to be united at the unconscious level. The masterminds of color revolutions know this well and have perfected the art. Symbolism is one of the most powerful tools to achieve this end. Revolutionary political organizations with surprisingly similar names and even more similar logos have appeared time and again, almost as omens marking the countries that would be hit by the colored plague next. They are often described as being aware and active when they're actually trained and radical. They are the ones who take the first shot, literal and metaphorical, to transform the peaceful protests into full-blown coup d'etats. Their fingerprints can be found everywhere on the map of the color revolutions. Using all the experience of past generations, simple but effective tools like catchy sing-alongs and chanting are employed. Well known for exciting the crowd and creating a group identity, they depersonalize individuals and make them easier to manipulate. Incidentally, one such organization, Romatske TV, received generous donations from the Dutch and U.S. embassies, as well as from the Renaissance Foundation, an NGO founded by George Soros.
I set up a foundation in Ukraine before Ukraine became independent of Russia. And the foundation has been functioning ever since. And it played an important part in events now.
I like criticism, but it must be my way.
We will be back here on this square to celebrate with you a Ukraine that stands with Europe and stands with the United States.
Well, members of Congress were visiting Ukraine during that period, most famously Congressman John McCain. So some of the people who were challenging their government, their elected government at that point, were being told by the senior U.S. official, a person who ran for president and a top official in the U.S. Congress, that the U.S. was with them.
I'm Senator John McCain, and it's always a pleasure to be back in Ukraine.
Senator McCain was, in a sense, giving the people in the Maidan a feeling that they had the backing of the most powerful country on earth.
This is about the future you want for your country. This is about the future you deserve.
In early February of 2014, as the Maidan crisis was getting more violent, there was a phone call that was intercepted. It was a call between the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, Victoria Nuland, and the U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt.
Questions of credibility are being raised after a private chat between two top U.S. diplomats was leaked online.
I think Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Klitsch and Tony Book on the outside. I just think Klitsch going in, he's going to be at that level working for Yatsenyuk. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Okay. Good. Well, do you want us to try to set up a call with him as the next step?
Sullivan's come back to me via VFR saying you need Biden, and I said probably tomorrow for an attaboy and to get the deets to stick. So
okay.
Biden's willing.
So you had this remarkable phone call where you have these two senior officials of the U.S. government apparently talking about a coup or how they were planning to restructure the government of Ukraine. I'm not saying the whole U.S. government feels that way. There is division on this, but the neoconservative element wants very much to change the strategic dynamic in Eastern Europe. The neocons are very smart people, and they've been at this for a long time. They came in around the issue of propaganda. They studied how to create hot buttons for the American people. They had this experience when they were getting the American people to get excited about Central America back in the 1980s. And they've been applying those same strategies ever since. They remain very dedicated to achieving their goals. They still want to get rid of certain governments. They wanted a regime change in Syria, for instance, regime change in Iran. They're very skilled at this, and they have a lot of allies now inside the news media, inside the government, and that means that they can do a lot to control the narrative of any story.
So I think in America these days, we have somehow told ourselves that there are a lot of ways of dealing with these problems other than hard power. Vladimir Putin cares about hard power.
The neoconservatives can now demonize a leader of a country. That sells with the American people. So you don't just sort of argue a policy. You attack the leader. So the neoconservatives became very skilled at picking out leaders, finding their ugly traits, and then highlighting them. Yanukovych, you might say, was a rather clunky political leader, but you make him into a devil. He's totally corrupt, and he's evil, and he wants to kill people in the Maidan, these wonderful white-hatted demonstrators. So you've got a black hat versus white hat. You keep repeating that basic scenario, and it works with the American people.
You've got to realize what Vladimir Putin is. He's an old KGB colonel that wants to restore the Russian Empire.
You make them into demons, and the American people find that the way they can understand the world. Once that happens, it's very difficult for journalists or anyone else to say, you know, hold it, that guy, he's got more of a gray hat than a white hat or a black hat. And if you say that, you suddenly are you're a Yanukovych apologist or you're a Putin apologist, and then the attacks come on to the person saying it, the journalist, the academic, or whoever.
Any good director will tell you that tempo and rhythm are the most essential components to hold an audience's attention. It can also be called a method of betrayal when the allies and followers are relentlessly thrown into the revolutionary flame. The idea is simple. When the preparation work is done, the trigger just needs to be pulled to set the machine into full motion. The murder of politician Rafiq Hariri led to the Cedar Revolution. Looking back at the mysterious poisoning of Viktor Yushchenko right before the Orange Revolution of 2004, we see now that he became a sacred victim himself. Most political analysts believe the compassion of the Ukrainian people at that moment tilted the scales, giving him the presidency. The number of victims among the protesters during Euromaidan totaled over 100. They are called the Heavenly Hundred. All the sacred victims were immediately mythologized. The beating of students on November 30th, 2013 was the obvious trigger of Euromaidan. Those who sent trained provocateurs to the square very well realized that peaceful protesters were the ones who would get hurt the most. It's hard to keep protests going for months on end. Tensions subside, and people inevitably get tired. Holidays are also a big danger for revolutionary masterminds. People want to be home with their families and friends, and one needs to get inventive to keep people in a cold, tense city. On Christmas Day of 2013, tabloid journalist and political wannabe Tatiana Chornovol was chosen to become the tool to whip the protests on Maidan back up.
A civic activist and journalist known for investigating corruption among senior officials was beaten outside Ukraine's capital on Christmas.
Her heroic deeds as a reporter looked more like petty crimes, trespassing on the presidential residence of Viktor Yanukovych, leading a rioting crowd to seize the Kiev City Administration building, breaking into a car of the Security Service of Ukraine. It looked like Tatiana was more interested in making news than reporting it, and gaining name recognition that could be turned into votes for her struggling political career in the opposition party Fatherland. She gave the world media a Christmas present in 2013, when she was cruelly beaten by unknown assailants on the road. Despite the fact that in just 3 days all the suspects were arrested and confessed to beating Tatiana during a road rage incident, world media kept insisting upon the political background of the crime. Instantaneously, Tatiana became a heroic martyr, uniting people around her image.
The beating coming amid political turmoil in Ukraine, this has drawn a protest.
Euromaidan was once again center stage, and Tatiana, in less than 2 months after the assault, she was already healthy enough to attack the office of Party of Regions, the party of Viktor Yanukovych. One of the staff members, 65-year-old IT specialist Vladimir Zaharov, was killed during the attack. So, where is Tatiana now? Well, she finally got her position of power in the new government. 1 month later, the time for another act in the play came. Armenian-Ukrainian protester Sergei Nigoyan was one of the first to arrive at Maidan. He wasn't radical or violent, but instead naive and full of hope. Watching Sergei read a patriotic poem is like watching a casting tape for the role of a sacred victim. Unfortunately, Sergei got the part. Betrayed by his brothers in arms, this video would eventually go viral after Sergei was killed early in the morning of January 22, 2014. The circumstances of his death remain unknown to this day. Even though the whole area of protests was heavily filmed at that time, there were no records or witnesses to help the investigation, and his body was moved immediately from the scene of the crime. Sergei became the first killed martyr of Euromaidan, and in a heartbeat, the police officers were appointed as his killers. Almost 2 years later, the official investigation would still deliver no results. Now, it is widely believed that Nigoyan's murder was staged by provocateurs to escalate the conflict. God speaks to people with the language of signs, On January 26, 2014, Pope Francis prayed for Ukraine, addressing thousands of people at St. Peter's Square in Vatican City.
Et Filius, et Spiritus Sanctus.
After the prayer, two white doves were released from the papal window and were immediately attacked by a crow and seagull. Those who understand the language could easily read the meaning of this omen. Soon, great forces, the seagull and the crow, would be tearing apart two Slavic nations, the white doves. This omen gave hope to the Ukrainian people, saying that by God's will, the doves would be saved. But it also predicted severe hardship and many victims. The events which could enter into the history of the color revolutions as the most massive human sacrifice yet arrived right on schedule, 1 month later. And here again we meet our old acquaintance from Narodny Rukh, Andriy Paruby, who is at the peak of his glory as self-proclaimed commandant of Maidan, which basically means the leader of the radical opposition.
The protesters were filmed leading a long line of riot police away. It's not clear where they were taking them. 67 officers are currently reported to be missing.
14 policemen dead and 43 wounded.
Earlier, from inside the protest camp, the opposition leader Vitali Klitschko urged his supporters to stay put. "Each of you here should stay strong in spirit," he said, "because we're not going anywhere."
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres says growing North and South divide is morally unacceptable and dangerous. We are prepared for you an article written by Karen McVeigh. The piece is titled UN Chief Says Perfect Storm of Crises is Widening Global Inequality. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has warned humanity is facing a perfect storm of crises that is widening inequality between the North and the South. The divide is not only morally unacceptable but dangerous, further threatening peace and security in a conflicted world. Antonio Guterres said the global food, energy and financial crises unleashed by the war in Ukraine have hit countries already reeling from the coronavirus pandemic and the climate crisis, reversing what had been a growing convergence between developed and developing countries. Antonio Guterres added, "Inequalities are still growing inside countries, but they are now growing in a morally unacceptable way between the North and the South, and this is creating a divide which can be very dangerous from the point of view of peace and security." Antonio Guterres, who spoke to The Guardian at the United Nations Ocean Conference in his hometown of Lisbon in Portugal recently, said his biggest concern was how global problems were widening the gap between the rich and the poor. He said, "What is worrying is we are living in a perfect storm, because all crises are contributing to the dramatic increases in inequality in the world, and to a serious deterioration in living conditions for the most vulnerable populations. All these escalated a situation in which a world that was looking like it was converging between developing countries and developed countries, even if inequality were growing within countries north and south. Now we are back to a divergence." Recently, the head of the United Nations World Food Programme, WFP, warned dozens of countries dependent on wheat from Russia and Ukraine risked protests, riots, and political violence as global food prices surged. Antonio Guterres said all the crises facing the world, the climate crisis was the most vital. He added, "That is why it is so concerning that the conflict in Ukraine has to a large extent kept out the focus on climate action. We need to do everything we can to bring again the climate issue as the most important issue in our collective agenda. It's more than the planet, it is the human species that is also at risk." The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres noted that while many important topics were addressed at the COP26 United Nations Climate Conference in Glasgow, Scotland last November, the central question of how to reduce emissions was not seriously discussed and continues to be ignored. He said there was agreement that to keep global warming down to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, deep cuts of 45% in carbon emissions by 2030 compared with 2010 levels were needed. But we are moving in the wrong direction. The UN Secretary General added, "The truth is that if we look at the national determined contributions we have today and what was announced before, during and immediately after COP26 summit, we're still moving into an increase of emissions of 14%. He added, "We have the risk of sleepwalking into the killing of the 1.5 degrees Celsius rise goal. Something is being done, but it is too little too late. If we want to keep 1.5 degrees Celsius alive, we need to have a massive determination to reduce carbon emissions as quickly as possible." He said all indicators suggest the effects of the climate crisis are accelerating faster than the worst predictions of a few years ago. Early this month, Guterres hit out at fossil fuel companies, describing them and the banks that finance them as having humanity by the throat, and castigated governments that failed to rein in fossil fuels and were in many cases seeking to increase production of gas, oil and even coal, the dirtiest of the fossil fuels. Asked about the backsliding of European Union countries that have announced plans to reopen coal-fired electricity-generating power stations in response to Russia's restriction of gas flows into Europe, Antonio Guterres said, "Coal is number one, is enemy number one of climate action." The UN Secretary General has called on Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD countries, to phase out all coal plants by 2030, and in other countries by 2040. He said, "I hope these examples of countries where some coal will be burnt will be for a very short period of time." Germany, a country heavily dependent on Russian gas, announced it would reopen mothballed coal-fired stations to conserve its supplies, following Russia's restrictions of gas flows into Germany. France has signalled it may reopen a coal station due to the situation in Ukraine. Antonio Guterres said the war had highlighted our dependence on fossil fuels. He said, "It is the instability in the fossil fuel market that is creating these dramatic impacts in rising energy prices and contributing to rising food prices and to the extremely difficult financial situation for many developing countries. If the world had invested massively, as it should have done, in the past decade on renewable energies, we would today be in a completely different situation." He added, "We need to learn lessons of the past." At the United Nations conference attended by global leaders and heads of state, the heads of small island developing states such as Palau, Fiji and Tonga spoke of the devastating impact on their countries from increasing typhoons and a rise in sea level. The Minister for Climate Change in Vanuatu, Silas Bulemelve, said the climate crisis was the single biggest threat to the country's efforts to expand its blue economy. On Monday, 4th of July, Antonio Guterres declared the world was in the middle of an ocean emergency and condemned the egoism of some countries that were hampering efforts to reach a long-awaited treaty to protect the world's oceans. A long-standing promise made in 2009 and brought to the fore at the COP26 summit in Glasgow from rich countries to provide £100 billion a year in climate finance to the developing world has not yet been delivered. Antonio Guterres said, although this finance was a small part of what is needed, the failure to honour the promise of providing it year after year has added to the division between rich and poor countries. He said, it probably won't happen in 2022. This makes developing countries feel that there is indeed not a strong commitment of solidarity. Small island developing states feel it with particular intensity. He said there is a risk of the next COP summit to be negatively impacted by this frustration of developing countries and lack of confidence and trust in the seriousness of the support of the developed world. And this would be tragic because we really need to mobilise everybody. We need everybody committed if we want to keep 1.5 degrees Celsius alive. Asked what gave him hope, Guterres said he had met many young people in Lisbon, part of a youth forum aiming to develop ideas and solutions to the ocean and climate emergencies. He said their depth of knowledge, their clarity, commitment in their proposals, and their enthusiasm is my best hope. Antonio Guterres concluded by saying, young people are engaged. We see more and more cities, more and more civil society, and even more areas of the private sector that are engaged. Governments are now becoming probably the entities that are moving more slowly.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Azam, ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. we are going to talk about the rules of Hajj, in fact, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad Hossein's program, and Sheikh Javid, as always, our guest speaker in the studio. Okay, Sheikh Javid, you know, we are talking about some of the jurisprudential rules for Hajj, and according to Ayatollah Khamenei, let's talk about some of the general rules for Hajj Tamattu. Would you shed some light on this issue?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In order for the for Hajj al-Tamattu to be valid, there are certain conditions to be fulfilled. First of all, intention is a requirement. It is necessary for the individual to form his intention. Obviously, every act of worship that is done must be coupled with intention. No act of worship is valid without pure and sincere intention. Therefore, the person who intends to perform Hajj al-Tamattu must make his niyyah that he will perform the Hajj in compliance with God's order and in obedience to his commandment. Right. So this is the first requirement. And of course, intention must begin from the time of wearing ihram, because ihram is the first act of Hajj. Every individual who wants to perform Hajj, any kind of Hajj, whether it is Hajj Umrah or Hajj Tamattu, must begin with or by wearing the ihram for Hajj, okay?
Yes.
And of course, when you perform Hajj Tamattu, you begin wearing the ihram from the station, from Miqat, and you start performing the Umrah of Tamattu. Mm-hmm. For a person who goes from remote areas,
yes,
not from the from within
the vicinity
of Mecca, because they are not supposed to perform Hajj Tamattu.
Right.
So it is necessary that one intend to perform Hajj Tamattu, otherwise his Hajj will not be in order.
Yes, of course, and no action or no ritual is accepted without this proper intention, right, as you said.
There's no amal done without niyyah. There's a hadith, in fact, related to the same thing.
Yes,
now, true. Then there is another condition, if I have time to continue with the rules.
Yes,
general
of
rules.
Course.
Of course, both Umrah and Hajj need to be performed in the months of Zilhajjah, okay?
Right.
The months of Zilhajjah. And mm-hmm. Zilhajjah is the month in which Umrah and Hajj Tamattu should be performed. No one can delay it or can do it before or after this month, or this month, the month of Zilhajjah. The Haji or the pilgrim must prepare himself to arrive in Mecca within the prescribed time, mm-hmm. within the time, mm-hmm. so that he may be able to perform Hajj within the prescribed time. You know,
I see.
So of course he has to many pilgrims, because we have pilgrims who arrive in Medina first of all, and then they go to Mecca. And then we have pilgrims who go straight to Mecca without going to Medina, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So there are two groups of
right.
pilgrims. Some go straight to Medina, they perform ziyara of the holy tomb of the Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, and they stay there for a few days, and then they set out and leave for Mecca. They go to Masjid Shajara, for example. They mm-hmm. perform, they wear the ihram, they do the talbiyah and make niyyah, and then move on towards Kaaba.
So is it necessary to go to Medina?
No, it's not necessary, you know.
Not even before Mecca or after one?
It is not necessary. But, it is very important to visit the holy
mosque,
Masjid al-Nabi, and the tomb of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him,
right.
and his family, and also the Baqiyah cemetery, okay, mm-hmm. where the four imams or the Shia imams are buried.
Yes, of
so,
course.
So of course, it is a very spiritual journey, and it is highly recommended.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws. Don't go away.
La ilaha illallah, wallahu akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad Hossein, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Sheikh Javid, you were talking about some of the general rules for Hajj Tamattu. Are there any more?
Sure. I want to say that one of the general rules for Hajj Tamattu is that the Umrah and Hajj need to be performed in the same year. In mm-hmm. the same year. And of course, there's also another condition. Umrah and Hajj should be performed for one and the same person, okay? If you are performing Hajj, you should do it for yourself, not on behalf of another person. And if you want to perform it on behalf, if you are actually a proxy doing mm-hmm. performing Hajj on behalf of another person, you should perform it on behalf of one person only. You cannot do it on behalf of too many people. You cannot consider or take too many people into your consideration and perform Hajj on their behalf. So Hajj is indivisible in the sense that it cannot be performed on behalf of different people.
So a group, the intention for doing the Hajj for a group is not possible.
Yes, and of course it implies that the person who is performing Hajj on behalf of, for example, of a dead person needs to perform both Umrah and Hajj himself.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are appointed as a proxy or a representative performing Hajj on behalf of a deceased person, like you're, for example, someone's has died, maybe he is your grandfather, and you perform Hajj on his behalf, you should perform it both Umrah and Hajj on his behalf. And then it's not permissible to separate between Umrah and Hajj. These are some general rules. Okay,
mm-hmm.
There are many conditions associated with both Hajj and Umrah. Of course, these conditions have been explained in the rituals or in the books, Hajj Manasik al Hajj or the Hajj rituals, authored by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei. And of course, for those people who wish to read and understand the details regarding Hajj rituals, I want them and I request them to read the Hajj book, mm-hmm. Hajj rituals,
yes,
for themselves in order to understand fully. Let's also not forget that many Shia Muslims who live in foreign countries, who live in a Sunni setting and a Sunni environment, are very much under the impression of the Sunni countries and mm-hmm. Sunni propagation.
Yes.
One should always keep himself abreast with the rulings and fatwa,
yes, exactly,
of the religious authorities, so as not to make a mistake. Because if you make a mistake and you get back home, you will regret, okay,
mm-hmm.
not learning about Hajj rituals and not understanding or asking someone, because there are many scholars,
mm-hmm.
there are many ulama who accompany these Hajj caravans or Hajj groups, and these are scholars who are ready every second and who are ready to answer questions. So
yes,
if a person entertains doubt about any act of Hajj, he should not hesitate to ask the alim or any alim that
exactly
is there to answer his or her question.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javed, for your nice piece of advice to be, in fact, conscious of the rulings of our own sect. Thank you very much for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. From me and the rest of the crew, until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم من جاء لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.